Hi there, I'm Deep Dillon. Welcome to your AI Injection, the podcast where we discuss state-of-the-art techniques in artificial intelligence with a focus on how these capabilities are used to transform organizations, making them more efficient, impactful, and successful. Welcome back to your AI Injection. This week's episode will continue our explorations in AI assisting in creativity and art. This week, we've got Andrew Levy. Andrew's a published poet and professor at the City University in New York. Levy's most recent publication, Artifice in the Calm Damages, is, in his own words, 175 pages of poetry, prose, essays, graphics, and the uncategorizable. We took some of Andrew's work and passed it through an AI text generator. We'll be discussing what came out, as well as some of Andrew's thoughts on using AI to assist in creative writing. So Andrew, get us up to speed on your background in poetics and how you approach writing and how that might be different than what most folks think of when they think of poetry and poets.
So I basically, didn't even get turned on to the fact that anybody even wrote poetry until I was about 20 because of my encounter with a professor who was an editor of a great magazine called Vort. And it was formatted where every issue was dedicated to two writers. He would have an extensive, long interview, and then the interview would be followed with a sample of their work. And then maybe half a dozen pieces by contemporaries who could say something about their work and put it into a context, right? So they were experimentalists. For example, one of the writers would have been Jackson McClough, who was a friend and contemporary of John Cage. They were both using chance-generated methods for producing their work. Both of them later in their life actually did experiment with computer-generated text using early programs where they could do diastics and acrostics. And so that's kind of like my grounding in the idea of art as experimental.
Kind of along those lines, within the world of experimentalism, what do you think the role of the machine is? Whether it's the pencil, and pen, or, the writing on the laptop or other tools.
It's funny you mention that now because I hadn't thought about this in a long time. A well-known poet, Charles Bernstein, I remember that he and I had a conversation back in the 80s, when people were getting their first PCs, right, that had about as much power as a pencil. And it was interesting at the time because the people that I knew that were getting computers first were some of the poets, not because I think they thought they necessarily were going to write their poetry, in their primitive word processing program. But I think just the whole idea of the machine just titillated people's imagination somehow. And then also with the advent of the internet, that possibility to communicate instantaneously at great distance with so many people was very enticing. But what I remember is that I was talking with him and he was like, I'm not going to write my poetry on the computer. I'm still doing that by hand. For some reason, some of the people that I thought of as the most experimental, it was like this kind of hesitancy to see the machine as a way to facilitate the composition of the poetry.
So, I know I exposed you to very large scale projects that are going on to train machines on, in essence, the sum of human publicly available writings in to learn language and say things. Like, most folks are quite amazed the first time they see the output of these systems. They're just like, wow, this very much feels like an actual human. We're just seeing like an uncanny output from these machines. And I guess a question for you is like, what was your first reaction when you started seeing stuff like this?
Well, my most intensive introduction to that is through another friend and colleague whose name is Andrew Klobuchar, and he's a professor at NJIT. Kind of his specialization is digital poetry and algorithmic derived work. And a few years ago, he was showing me some work where these artists slash performers were using computers in live performances, and they were writing code to treat and generate language. And then they were also doing this with music. And the thing that caught me up, that gave me a little bit of trouble in totally appreciating what he showed me or shared with me, was a big emphasis of this idea of improvisation. They consider themselves improvisers. They would talk about their coding, et cetera, in these performances as works of improvisation.
You're listening to Your AI Injection, brought to you by Xionix.com. That's Xionix.com. Check out our website for more content, or if you need help injecting AI into your organization.
Kind of, I wanted to go back to your idea of identity, because I think this is like a core part of the, you know, the question here is like, with these systems, like, what does it mean to have an identity when you've assimilated all of the writings of all of the humans that have ever put anything out that winds up on the internet? Like, what's the identity there?
That's a good question. Like, you know, I don't even know if identity is the right word, you know? There's another writer who is working on, I guess, some kind of career review of my body of work, right, so far. And he wrote me and he said, you know, the question I still have is, who is Andrew Levi? You know, and it's like, what's your identity? Who is the poet here behind these words? And I think it was because I problematized that issue of identity, of the author authorial identity in the work itself. And some of the writing and the poetry directly address that.
Decades ago, we used to talk a lot about this. I remember a bunch of our conversations of the, you know, the role of the poet as the, you know, the channeler or the antenna, if you will.
And the like, Spicer, Spicerian radio.
Yeah, idea. Yeah. The stripping out of the ego. And you're basically like a probe into this world, and you're just kind of like trying to funnel it, which is very anti-traditional poetry in many ways, right? Because traditionally, like, it's kind of all about the assertion of identity, and you're sort of intentionally stripping
you're right, but also that traditional idea is complicated because of the idea of the muse, who basically dictated their work to them. And as you know, Yeats has a whole book that he says was delivered to him that way, called A Vision, right, in which his wife basically was the channel through which the book was delivered.
If you saw this project by Ross Goodwin, who loads up this black Cadillac and he basically turns it into a quote antenna or channeler, if you will. It's got a video camera up on the front. It's got microphone, GPS coordinates, and he's trained up kind of natural language generation from these signals. And then he recreates some of the road trip of Kerouac, you know, in...
I think I read an article about this, Doug.
Yeah, he calls it One the Road instead of On the Road. And then the machine is, I mean, it's kind of literally, it's hard for us to think of the machine as having an ego in this sense, because it is, it's almost closer from the poetic sense of what we're talking about. But it generates some pretty wild, amazing, insightful stuff. And it's all based on what it sees while it drives across, you know, Kerouac's journey. And it's seeing things, it's hearing things, it's writing verse along the way. When we think of identity, it's kind of got an identity, at least in the sense that it's this thing that drove across the country, you know?
Right.
It's also got an identity in the sense that it's a collection of everything it's been trained on. But yeah, I mean, I think one of the places I wanted to take this conversation to was, what are tools that could really help, that can like dig into this elaborate world?
So you remind me of the kind of question I wanted to ask you was, in your mind, in your imagination, what would you imagine these AI systems to be able to be?
Yeah, I mean, that's a hard question to answer, because I think at the end of the day, like, none of us really know how these algorithms work. I mean, we know how they work.
Yeah.
We can author their architectures. Like we know, okay, well, there's, you know, 28 layers and, you know, like the lower layers are this and the higher layers are that. And we can sort of model them and we can sometimes like stick little probes in there to see like what are examples of what this layer is seeing and that layer is seeing. But we don't really know what they do. We can't wrap our heads around 175 billion parameters. These are like knobs and dials that this model iteratively tuned over many, many iterations as it was trying to fit a cost function, basically trying to predict the next sequence of characters and words across the entire sum of human knowledge. And in the process of that, it built up this network that we can't really wrap our heads around it any more than one of us can look in our own brains and figure out how our neurons are firing. We don't know that. We just know what we trained it on. We know what that does in smaller, more predictable contexts.
But wait a minute, are you saying this system is tuned and trained to digest different kinds of information for largely predictive purposes?
Yeah, that's exactly what they are. They're prediction machines that predict future character and word sequences. If you were brain dead and now all you see is text, and then you were only given the task to predict what the next word would be based on the text you've seen, that's what these systems are at the end of the day.
How and why have they been designed to be prediction machines?
Because as a result of that, you end up with a neural network structure that in essence understands language. So what's happening in this system, like when we give it your text, it's like your poem.
Yeah.
It's taking that poem and it's like navigating this complex information space that it's constructed, because it's just the first time we've really built things where they're so powerful that we're just surprised by them. It's like kind of uncanny. So that seed text, if you will, is kind of basically getting it to navigate that information space and start to find patterns in all the language that's ever been written that's closer to you and what you're writing. One of the things that's happening is it's also kind of, in a sense, sort of like ignoring a lot of the other stuff. You want to just like read that poem of yours, The Putative Tiring of Light. And if you can recite that for us, and then we'll look at what the machine's doing, and then let's talk about it. Like, you know, what's interesting and what's not, whether it's you or whether it's not you.
All right. So the title of this piece is The Putative Tiring of Light. It's dedicated to William Fuller. So the paradox of capitalist labor is a fine thing, but is not the place of sanctity. One dwells in the recognition of a demi-quintessence, hours of toil that vary with position or time, that eventually leaves one's pocket, ghost of the departed, slowed to an adagio, paralyzed by its haste. Everything else rots in hell in the unenviable position of having to study work and points of departure, perhaps some form of manual control, and neither very rational. Dialogue with one's material takes the optometrist job that smells of laundry soap and mildew along the hallway where the spiders hang in wait. I mean that literally and metaphorically. Adults who cry when they die did not have mothers who would comfort them. What is constant, if it exists, is not really constant. We're not people. We're lithographs. We're only real between acts. The best of our domestic imprecations allow one to expire, resplendent with desire, part of the unstoppable drift in time, and thus operative, imaginative trees becoming stars, creating space. Climbing down from my tree, the sole of my right foot keeps the only knowledge it retains on the top of my sandals. Striving in both construction and surface may be something ordained to serve us. A cactus garden, birds humming insects in the needles, succumbed by a regiment of idleness, an abyss of saffron fertilizer, Exxon tanks, soap plants spilling into key streams, neuromolecular death turning down the lender of last resort. Genius conjectures on lonely fantasies accidentally imprisoned in retirement to avoid an apology. Seeing that intimacy is effortless, it has no need to come inside one's cabin waving its feet in safety deposit envelopes of the divine, which heartbroken calls from the huge bedroom and cries, "The impeded stream is the one that sings."
Awesome. So I'm going to read for you the quote ending. So we fed this into GPT-3, and GPT-3 comes back and continues your poem and says, "It is easy to believe in the end of the world, and even easier not to. I know it will happen because my father told me so. The first half was a lie, and he would never tell me that part. But I have an idea about what happened before then. We were all naked and running around when someone invented clothes. It didn't matter who did it or how they came up with clothing. After that, everything changed."
Yeah. And looking at that now, I'm like, going, wait a minute, have you and I made a mistake? Are we sure this is the language that was generated from this poem and not one of the other two?
No, this was it.
This is it. This is it, right? And so it's kind of like, you know, so this is really interesting. You know, when I first read it and got back to you, I think this is the one where he said, well, this one's funny. And by funny, I meant interesting, right? Uh-huh. Like the other ones seem more prosaic. They almost seem like kind of literal explanations of the content of maybe something in one of the other two pieces. Whereas this got off and went in a slightly different direction. And also, you know, on the level of some of the word choice and content here, I mean, it says, "My father told me so." Well, there's no mention of a parent figure in the poem. There's no mother. There's no father.
Yeah.
So it's like, how did that come up? It's funny. And it's kind of almost nonsensical in parts and yet still makes sense. And then all the stuff about lying, the first half was a lie. We were all naked. We were all running around. And then somebody invented clothes. I mean, that sounds like a joke, right? It's like, that's the part that made me laugh. It's like, what? You know, because I like that. You know, that was kind of funny. And it turns out that this same poet, William Fuller, and I started an actual collaboration. So what I'm going to do is, on my next contribution, I'm going to put this in without telling him its origin.
Okay.
And I'm going to see what happens. And then I'm going to tell him what its source is and how it was generated. And then I'm just curious to see, like, is he going to pick up on anything in this? Because this is passable, I think, whether written by me or somebody else, or by the computer, where some of the other pieces that we tried didn't really gel, you know?
They didn't capture the kind of poetic.
Yeah, this one is actually what I would call kind of imaginative, right?
Yeah, and I think, you know, going back to that question of tooling, there's this idea of levels in creation, you know? And I kind of envision, like, over the next 10 years, you know, we're going to see an awful lot of creative tooling emerge that's going to allow people to, like, walk up levels and interact at the kind of levels they want to. And I think you'll have the ability, you know, at this, what I would call this is kind of a high level, right? Like you're saying, hey, finish my poem. Like that's a high level act. But there's other levels, like where you're just like kind of, you know, like there's simple stuff, like give me some synonyms here.
Well, you also made me think about, you know, the use of constraints to generate work is like the Alipo group, right? The famous artists, writers group. And yeah, they would do the same thing. They would set up very crazy constraints, like write an entire novel without using the vowel E.
Oh, that's right. Funny. I mean, I really love this idea of you've got some constraints that you put down or some tooling that helps you tap into this higher, deeper level of understanding of language that you can kind of reverse engineer into some tooling that ultimately helps put you in uncomfortable places or, you know, as a writer, or helps challenge you in some way that, you know, is kind of, you know, just out of your comfort zone. I mean, that feels to me like a type of tool that's very different than, like, what we've got so far.
And right. A kind of maybe last question for you.
Okay.
That I think kind of segues on that. And it's from the poem that I just read. So the first two lines, the paradox of capitalist labor is a fine thing, but is not the place of sanctity. So can AI be this place of sanctity in our culture?
I mean, that's up to us, right? Machine learning, artificial intelligence, as of today, and maybe the next 5 years, my guess is it's pretty much in the tool department. So if you use it to build a video recommendation engine that optimizes engagement on YouTube, that's a capitalist endeavor. But if you use it to have an assisted poetic experience and the poetry you're writing is transcended in some way or helping you get there, then you could say that the AI is a thing of sanctity.
I just heard that in what you were saying before, that this could be a really creative endeavor and tool. You know, all creative endeavors can be monetized, I guess, but in a way for the individual artist working who is not able to monetize anything. So it could be like a very different kind of tool, a very different experience.
AI is going to be the most prolific presence in our lives over the next 30 years. We just might not see it as such in the same way we don't think about it. I mean, that's what's going to happen with this stuff. And it already is. Like, there's a bajillion parts of your life every day you touch your phone where machine learning AI systems are constantly impacting your life. You just don't think about it that way. But going back to your sanctity argument, like to take it even a step further, like one of the things these systems do, then this would kind of go directly to kind of like my personal sense of spirituality. I don't know how we got there on this podcast, but like, what the heck? Why not be there? In my sort of spiritual sensibilities, the goal, quote, of a life is like where you're not thinking of yourself as this body and this individual perspective, but you're thinking of it as everything, all the living beings and humans, you know, and creation. And you're trying to process reality through the lens of what's good and wrong, right, and whatever for that collective entity. And when I look at these systems, that's kind of by default what we're doing these days, right? Like we're by default assimilating all of humanity into these language models, by default into these imagery models. And then now we're starting to couple the two with like, you know, text and images, and eventually it'll be audio and all the senses. And then they're always kind of by default, because it's just, we're always looking for more and more and more data. They're by default going to take the collection, at least of humanity. And so I don't know, like, is that a sanctity? I mean, I feel like there's some lesson there, you know, in terms of like the way we're thinking about knowledge in these machines as being collective and not like individualistic. I think there's some lesson to be learned about translating that back into how we actually, as our own constrained human minds, think. But yeah. That's all for this week. Thank you so much, Andy, for chatting with us. If you're interested in reading more of his work, check out Andy's book, Artifice in the Calm Damages. And if you're interested in learning more about GPT-3 and other AI-generated text capabilities, we've got a blog article up on our website with more details on this topic. You can find that at xionix.com/articles. That's xionix.com/articles.
That's all for this episode. I'm Deep Dylan, your host, saying check back soon for your next AI injection. In the meantime, if you need help injecting AI into your business, reach out to us at xionix.com. That's xionix.com. Whether it's text, audio, video, or other business data, we help all kinds of organizations like yours automatically find and operationalize transformative insights.